Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's neuroscience research podcast. Today is October 2nd, 2025? 2025? No, that's not what we say. 2025. And we have with us Dan Lodge.
Morning.
Dan is professor and chair of the Department of Pharmacology at the Long School of Medicine at UT San Antonio, which is also where we are, UT San Antonio. His research interests are broad, but they mainly center on control of dopaminergic systems by other brain regions in relation to psychiatric diseases, including schizophrenia. I hope that's not too far.
That's accurate.
Often, Dan is a longtime colleague of ours and not a newcomer to the podcast, but his previous appearance was actually a long time ago, in November 2009. That's episode 43, if you want to go back and hear that one. So welcome back, Dan.
I didn't realize it had been that long.
Also with us is Matt Wannett, local dopamine system expert and veteran of the podcast. Hi, Matt.
Howdy.
And me, I'm your host, Charlie Wilson. So, Dan, there's a relationship between brain dopamine function, famously, a relationship between brain dopamine function and schizophrenia. The original evidence for this that I know of was the strong correlation between therapeutic efficacy of antipsychotic drugs and their affinity as antagonists of the dopamine D2 receptor. And for almost as long, it's been clear that there's a lot more to it than just not too much dopamine somewhere. And so, because you can just crank up dopamine and you don't necessarily get schizophrenia, that's only the tiny tip of the iceberg of reasons for worrying about it. When you were here before, you gave us some evidence for the ventral hippocampus as part of a circuit for the positive symptoms of schizophrenia. And could you just start us out by bringing us up to date on that, on what parts of the brain we know are parts of that circuit and how they interact with dopamine?
Sure. So I think that the dopamine hypothesis is one of the oldest, but I think it's still relevant today. I think there's a lot of imaging studies now that show an increase in dopamine transmission in associative areas of striatum in patients with schizophrenia. Are antipsychotics, with the exception of KarXT and Cobenfy, which are brand new on the market as of last year, FDA approved non-dopaminergic antipsychotics. With that exception, all of them work by blocking dopamine D2 receptors. So there's a lot of support for the dopamine hypothesis. The downside of that is twofold. One, these antipsychotics are pretty good at treating one symptom domain, the positive symptoms. Typically, negative and cognitive symptoms are not well treated by these antipsychotics, suggesting that there's other parts of the brain that are mediating those symptom domains that aren't treated well by blocking D2 receptors. And I think the other thing that I find interesting is when you're looking at histopathology in the brains of patients with schizophrenia, you don't see a lot in the dopamine cell body regions. You see histopathology, but it's more localized to cortex and hippocampus. So that's why we started looking at afferent circuits that may contribute to this dopamine hyperfunction. Many, many, many years ago, we started looking at just normal circuits, trying to identify what circuits regulate dopamine system function in a normal animal. And then we've moved into rodent models that we use to examine schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, and Alzheimer's disease as well. What we believe is that the hippocampus is hyperactive in schizophrenia. And the reason for that is a loss of specific inhibitory interneurons in the hippocampus. This is supported by clinical observations. So postmortem studies have shown a loss of these interneurons in the hippocampus of human patients with schizophrenia. And imaging studies have shown this hippocampal hyperactivity in patients that's correlated with delusion severity and other symptoms. So, you know, I think as a preclinical scientist, it's always important to go to the clinical literature to make sure that what you're modeling is actually relevant to the human condition. Because if there's a disconnect there, it's more likely that the model's wrong rather than what you're seeing clinically is wrong. So I think there's clinical support. I think there's preclinical support. I think we're at a point now where we can use this information, hopefully, to come up with novel therapeutic approaches, because that is the end game for us and for our research.
So you mentioned loss of sort of inhibitory inner neurons within the ventral hippocampus. You know, there isn't just sort of one subclass of inhibitory neurons. And I guess, you know, if you are looking to target something, is there, you know, a specific population of inhibitory neurons that are potentially, dying off or not functioning properly in your models?
Yeah, what we've seen is it's primarily two subtypes. And from a neurodevelopmental perspective, they have a similar developmental trajectory. And that's pathalbumin and somatostatin. And we've actually done a bit of research. So schizophrenia is a neurodevelopmental disorder. And we've done some work looking at a number of different, totally different neurodevelopmental models. And we've done RNA-seq in the hippocampus to look at what transcriptional markers are changing during, like in utero, during neuronal development. And what we've found is that the homeobox genes that determine whether a inner neuron becomes a PARV or a somatostatin cell seem to be downregulated in all of these different conditions. And so we think that sort of sets the process off. And when you look in clinical and preclinical models, you have a loss of PARV and somatostatin inner neurons specifically.
Yeah. So that's on the, you know, positive side of things. I guess, what do we know now about maybe what's contributing to the negative side of things? Or would these, you know, ventral hippocampus, maybe is this a central node that might be spitting out into different pathways, the dopamine pathway, presumably more positive, and to other pathways to mediate negative? I guess, what's the larger state of the negative symptom?
It's a good question. And so, you know, we originally started on the dopamine hypothesis and coming up with ways to, you know, to try and treat that. But as I said, we already have D2 antipsychotic. Now, they're not perfect. We need better antipsychotic drugs. But we weren't focused on negative and cognitive symptoms. And so we did. We branched out and to look at behavioral correlates of those. And long story short, we found that the hippocampus is also regulating those negative and cognitive symptoms. And they're doing it through distinct neuronal circuits. So the hippocampal hyperactivity that goes through the nucleus accumbens and down to the dopamine system, we think is producing the hyperactivity and those positive symptoms. We can also show that that's associated in part with some of the reversal learning deficits, which are known to be associated with striatal dopamine. The hippocampus, and particularly the ventral areas that we are concerned about, also project a prefrontal cortex. And prefrontal cortex is a place where you have executive function and you also have social interaction deficits. So what we did using a rodent model is we did chemogenetics to inactivate specific populations, those projecting to nucleus accumbens and those projecting to prefrontal cortex. And what we saw is that when you inactivate the hippocampal projection to accumbens, you can reverse some of the behavioral deficits, the reversal learning, and those that sort of mirror positive symptoms. And when you inactivate those going to the prefrontal cortex, you can reverse the cognitive deficits and the social isolation or the problems with social interaction. So we really think there's a hippocampal specific focus, and that by targeting that hyperactivity, not only may you fix the hyperactivity of the dopamine system and the positive symptoms, but you may also start to hit negative and cognitive symptoms as well.
So that, I mean, brings up sort of an interesting point about talking about, you know, schizophrenia as a developmental disorder. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, typically in the early 20s is sort of when it really manifests. And there might also be some sex differences in sort of the onset as well, if I remember correctly. But I guess can we use these preclinical models to sort of understand, you know, what changes are happening before we start seeing the behavioral symptoms? And, you know, do we have a better idea of when the sort of, you know, preclinical onset might be? And is there therapy that potentially you could give to individuals who might have a higher genetic predisposition to developing schizophrenia? And I guess, where's the therapeutic potential on that? And, or are we years, decades away from being able to tackle those questions?
Well, so this is a hot button issue because... So let me tell you a bit of science, but then I'll tell you how I think that there may actually be ways that we can reverse that trajectory. So we've looked previously at peri-adolescent, you know, rat models to see if this hippocampal hyperactivity is present. And it looks like it may be. But the way that the brain responds to dopamine changes across adolescence as well. So we think that some of the pathology could actually be there early. But sort of going meta and a little bit bigger, schizophrenia is a genetic disorder because there is inheritance of it. If you have the general population, the probability is about 1% of developing schizophrenia. If you have a family member, a parent or a sibling, it gets to 10%. If you get to an identical twin, it's about 50%, so it's 50-50. But that tells you the genetics by itself isn't sufficient. And so there's a number of risk factors. A lot of them are obstetric complications, prenatal hypoxia, prenatal infection. But some of them are things that are potentially modifiable. And one is adolescent cannabis use. And there was a study, I think it came out about 12 months ago. I think it was a Dutch study, I may have the country wrong, that suggested that about 15% of schizophrenia cases can be prevented if we, if those patients discontinued or didn't abuse cannabis. And so this is something that used to be correlational, and there was a lot of questions about cause and effect. I think the field is centered around that this is probably a significant risk factor. They're talking heavy cannabis use and during the adolescent period. The issue we've got is that it seems to be only in patients with a genetic predisposition. So understanding who those patients are is the problem.
So along those lines, though, if I remember sort of the original argument about this was, are those individuals taking cannabis because they're sort of self, you know, medicating their symptoms in a way? And I guess, has there been any greater teasing apart from that study or not? Or is that idea been pushed to the wayside?
No, so I think that there's more clinical data.
And the smoking as well. There's a higher incidence of smoking cigarettes.
And I think the data on cigarettes is still, that's probably therapeutic and self-medicating. People who smoke, I think there's a higher incidence of cigarette smokers in schizophrenia patients. And when they smoke deeper and they really try to extract nicotine. So that seems to be a self-medication. We did some studies to try and tease this apart. So we had a rodent model that had a susceptibility to developing schizophrenia. So this is a model where we manipulated a pregnant dam. She gave birth. Those animals were mated to create a second generation and even a third generation. So there was an inheritance of it. And we saw a phenotype in about 40% of the animals. So we used this as a model of genetic susceptibility. What we did in those models is a really simple experiment where we used a CB1 agonist during the adolescent period. And what we saw is that the percentage of rats that had a phenotype went from 40% to 80%, so it doubled. In the control animals, nothing changed.
So what would really settle the issue is to know the mechanism. And so do we have any guesses? So much is known about CB1 receptors and what they do.
So we've got a guess, because what we did is we looked at pavalbumin expression in the hippocampus, and we saw it was essentially a two-hit model. Both of those things caused a decrease in pavalbumin, and once you got to a threshold, you got a phenotype and symptoms. That's what we think is happening. The interesting thing, and we've also worked on this not for a few years, but back in the day, is it looks like endogenous cannabinoids may actually be beneficial. So there was a cannabinoid hypothesis that thought that maybe endogenous cannabinoids were elevated in schizophrenia and contributing to symptoms. And so, a colleague of mine actually tested that many years ago, where he looked in the patients with schizophrenia and saw elevated cannabinoid levels. But then he did one more thing and correlated those levels with symptoms, and they were inversely correlated, suggesting that it was actually a protective mechanism. And we've done a lot of work to try and differentiate what happens with THC when you take in exogenous marijuana and compare it to endogenous endocannabinoids, which are released on demand in specific brain regions. And that looks like that may actually be beneficial, whereas THC may not be.
So are rates of schizophrenia going up now that there's a greater amount of legalization? And I guess kids have always been experimenting with drugs, but I would say the accessibility of cannabis is probably a lot higher now than it was back in the day. But should we be expecting sort of an increase in the incidence of schizophrenia with higher use amongst juveniles?
It depends on what the use patterns are going to be, because I think it really is the heavy use that is more, that there's more data supporting the hypothesis of heavy use. So people that are light recreational users, it doesn't seem to have that association. So I guess, you know, the answer is maybe. The other risk factor that is probably not modifiable is prenatal infection. And that's something that we've had a lot of over the last 5 years. And so how that and adolescent cannabis use result, whether it results in changes in the incidence, I think is something for an epidemiologist to look at. But I think there's certainly going to be data in the future around that.
So in our podcast, we have many times had guests who are talking about hippocampus function, and none of them, except you, have been talking about schizophrenia. What they talk about, like just last week's podcast, was about place cells in the hippocampus, and it really sounded like spatial map of the world is the job of the hippocampus, and maybe it spills out into temporal sequences and episodic memory. And so is there a way to connect these two things together? Is there like episodic memory defect in schizophrenia or a spatial navigation defect?
I think a lot of this comes down to the parts of the hippocampus. So in preclinical models, you have dorsal and ventral. In humans and primates, you have anterior, posterior. And there is a difference in the function of those anatomical sites, where the posterior or the ventral are more limbic-related regions of the hippocampus. That's where we see the majority of the pathology. I think when you start to hit deficits in dorsal hippocampus, that's when you're going to get those semantic memory impairments. More so than in the ventral, where you get more of the emotionality because of the connectivity with the limbic regions. We've actually started to look at models of Alzheimer's disease, which has a pretty significant hippocampal component to it. And one of the earliest symptoms is memory impairment. And what you see is there's a huge comorbidity of psychosis in patients with Alzheimer's disease. And if you look at like amyloid plaques and look at the neuronal loss, some of the first cells to go are those with the high metabolic demand, which are the pavalbumin interneurons. And so what we think is happening in some of these other models, like Alzheimer's, which is most often thought of as a memory impairment disorder, is that in areas of the hippocampus, you get pockets of hyperactivity. And when that's in the ventral regions, then it feeds into the circuits that we've studied for years and ends up producing this hyperdopaminergic state, which can then lead to psychosis in Alzheimer's patients. So I think it's, well, we've studied this for years. It's not just place cells. Place cells are some of the coolest cells in the brain. But there is an interaction between all of this. And I think it makes sense. You know, if you think about your own experiences with memory, they can trigger emotional responses. So memory is not just spatial, like how did I get into the room? But there's also, you know, someone walks past wearing a cologne that you haven't smelled in 20 years, and that can elicit strong emotions. And I think that's through those limbic areas. These limbic areas also encode novelty and things like that, which change the salience of stimuli. And so I think the hippocampus, while it plays a central role in memory formation, also has this additional role that...
So getting at the mechanistic follow-up, sorry, Charlie,
your point was
you know, if you're saying that in schizophrenia, it's, you know, selectively affecting the SST and the PV inner neurons that you have in the ventral hippocampus, but they're not having an effect in, you know, the dorsal hippocampus normally involved with, you know, the memory place cells. What's different about the inner neurons as we go from, you know, a ventral to dorsal gradient? And that might be sort of informative of, again, therapeutic targets, but kind of interesting in a way that there's got to be some difference.
Yeah, I for Journal Club, picked a paper that I'm not going to talk about today that the labs looked at. And this is only focusing on ventral. And what we found is that based on where the hippocampal pyramidal cells are projecting, the interaction with PARV and somatostatin cells is different. So pyrimidine cells in the ventral hippocampus are synapsing on pyramidal cells that are going both to accumbens and up to prefrontal, whereas somatostatin cells seem to only regulate those cells going to accumbens and don't form as many synapses on cells projecting up to prefrontal cortex. So even within the ventral regions, there's a differential regulation of pyramidal cells by SST and PV cells. What's happening in the dorsal, we don't know. I think you still get a loss, but the consequence of that, I think, is different than what it is in the ventral.
Cool.
So, okay. What do we know about the activity of the parvalbumin versus somatostatin GABA cells in the hippocampus? Do they get inputs from different places? Are there, we talk about the pyramidal cells, we're always thinking about entorhinal cortex and grid cells and all that kind of stuff. Those inputs go to the interneurons as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of feed-forward feedback inhibition. And if I'm being brutally honest, that's sort of outside of my wheelhouse. What we're more focused on is the interneurons themselves, because they're the ones that are selectively lost. But what's interesting...
carrying different channels of information from that.
Well, and that's the thing. So the PARV cells are typically, they have a high firing rate. They synapse on the initial segment. They're perisomatic targeting. So they're really set up to regulate the output of pyramidal cells. Somatostatin cells are a little different. They sort of synapse up there in the distal dendrites. And so they play more of a regulatory role over the function of pyramidal cells. We've done some work, and I mentioned this to the students this morning, about testing your hypothesis. If our hypothesis is a loss of these cells is producing deficits that look like schizophrenia, then in theory, putting the cells back should fix it. And we've done that using interneuron transplants. We made populations of PARV cells, populations of somatostatin cells, transplanted them into the hippocampus of our models of schizophrenia, and showed that they can rescue specific behavioral and neurophysiological deficits.
So you made these out of IP cells or something?
Yeah, these are made out of IP cells. They had a reporter so that we could separate early versus late born. They actually had two reporters on them. So we basically went through a culture procedure that gave us a decent population, but then we sorted them with flow cytometry. So we took only the parvalbumin cells or only somatostatin cells, and then we literally injected them into the brains of our rats. What's cool about transplanting GABA neurons is they don't have to go anywhere. They just need to form synapses locally. And so you don't have to worry about trying to make them go to another brain region like you would with a projection cell. We did electrophysiology showing that they functionally integrate within the circa. A reviewer asked us a really interesting question and said, if this is really it, then if you turn them off, the deficit should come back. And I rolled my eyes, but we did the experiment where we, in those cells, we put a chemogenetic virus where we could silence them. And so we transplanted them to reverse the deficits, but then we silenced them and the deficits came back.
You're just silencing the transplanted neurons.
Just the transplanted neurons, nothing else. What's interesting about it is, you know, when I sent this up to NIH and to colleagues, they're all like, this is great. It proves your primary hypothesis, but it's never going to be a treatment. You're not going to transplant cells into the brains of patients. But now there's a company called Neurona Therapeutics that I'm not associated with in any way, shape, or form that have done exactly that. They've grown these cells in a dish, made them so that clinically they can be used. Their initial target is epilepsy, but it's also targeting hippocampus. They've transplanted them into the brains of patients with epilepsy and saw significant reductions in seizure frequency in those patients. So, you know, what we've done preclinically may actually have some therapeutic utility down the road if this company continues to see positive results in epilepsy patients.
How long lasting did you sort of track the survival of these cells? And I guess...
long, long time. So the honest truth is when you transplant a bunch of neurons, a bunch of them die straight away. And I think that's to be expected. But then the ones that we kept looking, I think we've looked up to 6 months after, and they're still there. They really do functionally integrate in circuitry. Because they have a reporter, we can find them. We can patch onto them. Our colleagues can, and figure out what they're doing. And so, yeah, they seem to be surviving long-term once they're transplanted. And I think the clinical data is supporting that as well. Yeah, that's cool.
So it seems if you sort of can work backwards up the causal chain, you find out what's causing the depletion of the interneurons, mm-hmm. you're getting close to the causal mechanism of schizophrenia.
I believe so, but I believe it's probably, I think there's multiple ways. I don't think there's just one schizophrenia. I think each patient presents with different symptoms and different, not different symptoms, different degree of the relative symptoms. And so I think there are going to be some that are associated primarily with hippocampal hyperactivity, but I'm not 100% sure that's going to be all subjects. And I don't know if we have an answer to that question yet. I think having a hippocampal specific mechanism that we can target, once we understand that we get target engagement in patients, that will start to tell us, is this an effective approach in a subset of patients, in all patients? I think that really requires clinical data.
Are there some maybe lessons we can get from like Parkinson's disease, where, you know, we've got a selective degeneration of dopamine neurons here, and one of the, you know, hypotheses is, you know, maybe misfunctioning mitochondrial function. Like, are there some things like that that might be contributing to then the selective loss of the interneurons in the ventral hippocampus that might be contributing? And are there sort of general themes we might see behind these, you know? I mean, there's a developmental component, you know, time, it emerges over time, and there's can be a genetic component of it, and you get selective cell death. Yep. Like, are there some, you know, preventing mitochondrial dysfunction? Is that something that might be playing a role, or?
Yeah, I think.
Are they separate?
No, well, they're separate, and I think they add together. So the oxidative load that you get, you know, we've done some work with repeated phencyclidine administration, which is a totally different way to induce a model that has aspects of schizophrenia. And what we showed is that there's a significant increase in oxidative damage, and the PAV cells are sort of uniquely sensitive to that increased oxidative load. So I think there's a multiple hit model where stress could be a factor. Hippocampus is a stress-sensitive region. There's a bunch of genetic, so it's a polygenetic disorder, but I think any of those that sort of take away a PAV cell, its ability to deal with oxidative damage makes it susceptible. So I like to think of it, and this is just in sort of my area of research, that the PAV cells are uniquely susceptible, but there's a number of different ways that you can damage them. And the multiple hit can be genetic, can be environmental, and then once you get to a certain level, then you get dysfunction of the neuron. And once you lose, or we still don't know whether it's a loss of cells or a loss of PAV albumin within the cells, resulting in the cells being essentially non-functional. To me, it doesn't matter, because the end result's the same. But I think once you get to the cliff, that cell's non-functional. So I like to think of it as a multi-hit sort of model.
So I'm wondering how to think about the output of the hippocampus. I always ask everybody about the output of the structure they study, and they always hate it because that's not the structure I study.
Yeah.
That's the output of the structure. Yeah. But what kind of signal is being carried by the hippocampal neurons, like the ones that go to nucleus accumbens, the ones that go to cortex? Mm-hmm. Is just firing too much? Is that it? And if you just fire too much, then what happens? I mean, what does it mean for the hippocampus to be firing too much?
Yep.
And how would that produce, you know, a hallucination? Which seems like not just something that's cranked up. It seems like it has structure to it.
The way we think about it is at the level of the dopamine system. So having the hyperactivity in the hippocampus means that the dopamine system, let me go back. What I think the hippocampus is doing is sort of changing the gain of the dopamine system. So allowing that system to be turned up or turned down based on environmental context, novelty, whatever the case may be. If you're having hyperactivity in that circuit, you're basically taking that gain, turning it up. You lose that ability to regulate it. Now, whenever a stimulus comes in, it gets this big dopamine signal, this high salience that says, hey, pay attention to this. And so you've lost the regulation so that everything now is coming through with that high salience.
Everything seems significant.
And everything seems significant.
So things have significance that don't really have significance.
Yeah. And so I think that is where some of the paranoia comes in. The person on the television is talking to me. I've got to pay attention to them. Uh-huh. The person walking down the street, I've got to pay attention to them. And I think it's because you've lost the ability to assign salience to a stimulus.
So is the ventral hippocampal inputs to the dopamine neurons, is it affecting circuit-specific, you know, dopamine outputs, or is it sort of a global, like hitting all dopamine output projections?
So the way it comes in is it comes in through accumbens through VP. Okay. And then VP
ventropalatin,
which is regulating dopamine system function. For years, we didn't know what that input really looked like. And we actually have a paper that's coming out in 2 days where we've looked at that. And so what we think is happening is at rest, ventropalatin has a high rate of activity. It's tonically active, and it's suppressing about half of the dopamine neurons in the VTA. And they're shut down. They're not spontaneously active. What the hippocampus is doing is it's coming in to the nucleus accumbens and it's turning those VP cells off. And so you're losing that. So what we think is at rest, there's about half the cells in the VTA that don't receive an input from the ventral palatin. And they're chugging along doing their thing. The hippocampus through the ventral palatin is increasing a different population of dopamine cells to allow them to participate in whatever's going on. So that's the population that's changing. Now, where those cells go and what they do is going to be the follow-up to this paper. it's a really good question because we really didn't know if it was, you know, if every dopamine cell received an input from the ventral palatin and it was this master orchestrator that could just say, you know, but what we actually think and what the data supported, we did some electrophysiology, we also did some tracing studies, is that we think about half the cells are receiving that input. They're tonically inhibited by the ventral palatin. But then when afferents come in, they can be, they can start firing. And then their pattern and their activity is driven by other afferent circuits.
Well, great. Thanks, Dan. That was really, really great. And I know there's a lot more we could talk about, but we should move on with the day.
Say that in another 9 years or
more. I was going to say, I'll be back in 16 years.
So thanks, Dan Lodge, Matt Wannett. This has been Neuroscientist Top Shot.